Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, David Levithan, Michelle T., and William Ritter discuss fantastic sequels. In Another Day, best-selling author David Levithan tells a story about discovering the truth about love and how it can change you. Girl at the Bottom of the Sea, Michelle T's sequel to A Mermaid in Chelsea Creek, finds our hero Sophie traveling from Massachusetts to Poland with her unlikely guardian, the mermaid Serena. In Beastly Bones, the follow-up book to the acclaimed Jacoby, William Ritter tells of a supernatural investigation from the perspective of Abigail Rook, R.F. Jacoby's assistant. This panel was moderated by Allison Clement, author of 20 Questions. David Levithan is the author of numerous books for young adults, including Boy Meets Boy, the Lambda Literary Award winner Two Boys Kissing, and Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which was adapted into a film starring Michael Cera. Levithan is an editorial director at Scholastic and the founding editor of its Push imprint, which is devoted to finding new voices and new authors in teen literature. Michelle T. is an author, poet, and literary organizer. Her award-winning memoir, Valencia, was adapted into a feature-length film shot by 21 independent filmmakers as a collaborative film arts project. T. is the founder of the literary nonprofit Radar Productions and the co-founder of the infamous spoken word tour, Sister Spit. William Ritter is the author of two young adult novels, Jacoby and its sequel, Beastly Bones. He is a graduate of the University of Oregon and currently teaches high school language arts and mythology. The moderator of this panel is Allison Clement. She is the author of Pretty Is as Pretty Does and 20 Questions, which won the Oregon Book Awards Ken Kesey Award for Fiction in 2007. Now, from Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in November 2015, here is David Levithan, Michelle T., and William Ritter in conversation.
My name is Allison Clement, and I am the moderator. And these are our authors. This is David Levithan, Michelle T., and William Ritter. Each author will read for a little while, and I'll ask them some questions, and then we'll open it up to you guys. So be thinking of questions you'd like to ask the authors while they're reading, okay? William Ritter graduated from the University of Oregon. He currently teaches high school language arts, including reading and writing, mythology, and heroes. He is a proud husband and the father of two children. When reading aloud, he always does the voices. Beastly Bones is his second novel, so let's see if he does the voices.
Pressure. Hello, I'm all of those things. My first book, my debut, was called Jacoby. It is called Jacoby, and this is the follow-up to that. So I know many of you have not gotten a chance to read that one, so I'll give you a little intro to that before I read an excerpt of the sequel. Jacoby is a young adult's period murder mystery. It's set at the turn of the century. My publishers promoted it as Sherlock Holmes meets Doctor Who, and I want to read that book, so I was happy with that. It's a paranormal mystery. The lead detective is a man named R.F. Jacoby, who can see things that other people can't see. He's a seer, and so that's sort of his cheat as a detective. He's able to see supernatural creatures, pixies and fairies and trolls and things. And his Watson character is a young woman named Abigail Rook, who has found her way from England over to New England, where she gets a job with Jacoby. So in the first book, he really is the authority, and she's very much a newcomer in a new world, learning new things. And in Beastly Bones, I've given her a chance to really be a little more of the authority. So she is getting a chance to stand on her own two feet, but she's still figuring out who she is. So in this section, young Abigail Rook is dealing with whether or not she's going to kind of pursue one direction or another. And her good friend Jenny has advised her to, you know, go out there and kiss the boys, have a good time, and enjoy yourself. And she's just met someone else who is inspirational to her, who gives her the opposite advice: stay away from boys, you need to just focus on your career because you don't want to get tied into an apron and never do anything exciting again. So dealing with that, she then has this opportunity to go and take a walk in the sunset with this boy that she's kind of been falling for, and she says no. And this is the scene directly following that moment. We'll make more progress in the daylight, sir, I'm sure. Come on then. I'll walk you back to the cabin. If we're going to brood over fruitless frustrations and complicated casework, we might as well enjoy a sunset along the way. Charlie says that they're quite nice out here in the country. I sighed. Still, that find, Mr. Jacoby, I'm still having trouble believing it. That's something. Electromagnetic radiation traveling through the atmosphere along an inconsistent wavelength, said Jacoby, standing up. And also magic. There's a phoenix involved. Come again? The sunset. Of course, it also has a traditionally romantic connotation. You aren't making any advances, are you, Miss Rook? I have strict parameters about that. Very unprofessional. It was never a problem with Douglas.
No, I most certainly am not making advances. For goodness sake, not making advances is exactly what I'm doing, in fact.
Ah. Jacoby nodded. We walked in silence for several seconds.
It's just that Jenny told me I should...
I really don't need to know, Jacoby said.
But then Miss Fuller said that I shouldn't...
Please don't, Miss Rook.
Oh, never mind. I feel hot and embarrassed and I wanted to hide. Forget I said anything.
I assure you I will ardently try.
The black teeth of the tree line had swallowed up the sun like a ripe grapefruit, and the seeping mess of red and orange had begun to spread across the sky. It might have been every bit as lovely as he had said, but I was finding it difficult to appreciate. The crimson-tinted countryside passed by us in silence for a dozen paces.
So often, Jacoby said, people think that when we arrive at a crossroads, we can choose only one path. But as I have often and articulately postulated, people are stupid. We're not walking the path, we are the path. We are all of the roads and all of the intersections. Of course you can choose both. I blinked. Also, if I hear any more nonsense about you allowing other people to decide where you're going in your own life, I will seriously reconsider your employment. You were hired for your mind, Miss Rook. I won't have an assistant incapable of thinking for herself.
Yes, sir, I said. Thank you, sir.
The sky reached its richest red and then slipped into a deep purple and finally the blackness of night just as we arrived. The stars blinked down on us and the moon washed the cabin in gentle blues. It had indeed been a beautiful sunset.
Thank you for that. I was interested when I was reading your books about the use of mythology, and then earlier this morning you were talking to me about the different kinds of myths that inspired you. Would you talk a little bit to the audience about that?
Sure. I teach mythology. It was one of the first classes that I got to teach when I first got a teaching job. It was a job that I shouldn't have gotten right out of college, and was told, all right, you've just been hired, you've got nothing but a degree behind you, and here's this position, it's creative writing and mythology, would you like to teach it? Sure, why not? So I love teaching mythology, but all of the myth classes that I've inherited as a teacher have been Edith Hamilton's Greek mythology, go. And Edith Hamilton does a good job of compiling a lot of myths, but she is dry. And what I like to teach my students is, well, I love Greek mythology, there are other cultures in the world. So I opened it up a little bit, and I broadened. I went first to Greek, Norse, and Native, within just kind of a little world tour at the end, just to get samplings from around the world. And this year, I've gone off of a new book. David Adams Leeming has a collection called World of Myth, which is marvelous, and it organizes by archetype rather than by geography. And so I love that book, and I love showing my students, here's, you know, pantheons from Egypt and from the Norse and from the Greek too, that's good. And my students respond to that wonderfully. They love getting to see things that they haven't seen before, and as much as many of them have read Rick Riordan and they've gotten into the Greeks, and that's great, they like knowing that there are other cultures in the world, and they rally at the opportunity to celebrate other societies and other ways of thinking about things. And when we only focus on just one, you know, just Western society, we miss out on lots of really cool philosophical ways of thinking about the world. And so I definitely wanted to put some of that into the books. In the first book, there's a sequence where Abigail has noticed paintings facing each other that don't seem to go together, but at the same time go together, and it's paintings of Manu and the fish from Hindu mythology and St. George and the dragon from Catholic mythology, and it's sort of two stories about how to deal with the supernatural world, and one of them is about conquest and fighting dragons, and the other is about listening to a fish. And so it's a lesson that she gets there that dragon slayers are important, but there are a lot of dragon slayers in the world, and sometimes what we need is someone who's willing to listen to a fish. And so I try and get that across to my students all the time, that there are other ways of thinking and that mythology can teach us that if we're willing to listen.
Thank you. And I'd like to introduce Michelle T. She is the author of 4.5 memoirs. Is that right? 1.5 novels. two young adult novels, and a collection of poetry. Her memoir, Valencia, is an underground classic and has been made into a feature film. She's the founder and executive director of Radar Productions, a literary nonprofit, and the founder of Sister Spit, a lesbian feminist spoken word and performance art collective based in San Francisco. Michelle is a former writer of horoscopes and a current reader of tarot cards. Would you read to us? I liked what William said. Reminded me of your pigeons having things to say to people. You know that you also have various creatures that speak to us and have messages.
That's what's so much fun about this kind of writing is that you can do that. You know. So I'm going to read, excuse me, from the beginning of Girl at the Bottom of the Sea, which is the sequel to Mermaid in Chelsea Creek, and there will be a third book when I'm done writing it. And so I think all you need to know is that the hero, Sophie, at the end of the first book, she'd gone to the dirty creek in Chelsea to meet with the mermaid, Serena, who swam all the way from Poland to kind of be her guide. And she's going to the creek to swim back to Poland with Serena. And a lot of her supporters in Chelsea, Massachusetts, the city that it takes place in, which is a real town where I grew up, are there with her. But as they're getting ready to say goodbye, the kind of evil force in the book, which it's an evil energy, but it's taken the form of her grandmother, Kishka, sort of summoned the water in the creek and in the bay and kind of created this giant fist-shaped rogue wave to kind of pummel them. So that's kind of where we're at right now. When Kishka's mighty fist came down, Sophie felt herself fall to pieces. Though the pain was too great to fully comprehend, it was as if her body had become liquid inside, and her bones and muscles were being ground into the trash and silt beneath her feet. She felt the mermaid torn away from her, thrown up into the sky. And before she could cry out, Sophie was flying too. As hard as she had been punched down into the creek bed, so did the force of the wave catapult her into the air. By the last light of the sky and the faraway street lamps ringing the housing projects, Sophie and the very creek took flight. A shopping cart whizzed by, a car door, a small refrigerator. Like a girl in a horrible snow globe, she was suspended in a confetti of creek mud, stuck here and there with rocks, bits of brick, and chunks of cement. From her vantage, she could see all of Chelsea, the old-fashioned dome of City Hall, the red and white checked water tower at the top of Soldier's Home, the Tobin Bridge like a length of green Legos stretching into Boston, and even Boston itself with its glittering buildings, and all around it, water. Time seemed to slow as Sophie flew above the city, and she looked down upon it. How small Chelsea looked, how tender it suddenly seemed, with its twinkling streetlights, the yellowy glow coming through the windows while inside, families ate dinner, oblivious. Even the groups of boys gathered in the city square, the ones who so often yelled after Sophie and forced her to take a different route home, seemed innocent to her now for all they didn't know. They thought that Chelsea was simply a city, a banged-up urban playground that held and trapped them. They had no idea that it was so much more, the birthplace for an ancient magic that had suddenly and powerfully awoken, a magic that was inside Sophie, that threaded through her family, coming down from her ancient and terrible grandmother, who seemed to have become the poisoned creek itself, and was now sending her granddaughter so many miles above the town that it looked like a child's toy beneath her, its graffitied walls and trash-strewn curbs no longer visible. But at Sophie's wild height, with time slowing down around her as she tumbled from the sky, with all that she had learned racing through her head, Sophie saw only home. What a strange way to leave home for the first time, she thought as she flew. Her heart rang out for this town that had bugged her so hard, its packs of boys that menaced her, its dirty creek and beat-up parks. It's mine, she thought, mine to protect and return to, mine to save for my grandmother. At that thought, the wave that had lifted Sophie so violently into the air shattered around her like glass, and in every drip and drop, every splash, were the many faces of Kishka. Kishka the dragon, Kishka the grandmother, Kishka the young beauty, and Kishka the swirling darkness, the very fabric of terror, the power that every act of evil draws its energy from. Let's stop there. No voices in that passage, thank goodness. It's a hard act to follow.
So many of your passages show your poetic background. They seem really dense and vivid and beautiful to listen to.
Thank you.
Earlier, we were talking about your experience when you went to Poland. Would you share that with the audience?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's a lot of Polish mythology. I mean, really, the point of the book is this Polish mythology, and I have a Polish background. Like the last name I was born with was Iswankowski, but the Polish part of my family I was really estranged from, so I don't really know anything about it, and I started kind of fetishizing it in this way, like, what does it mean that I'm Polish, you know? And I miraculously got a grant to go to Warsaw and teach a writing workshop for feminists. And let me tell you, the state of feminism is really hard in Warsaw, and like the feminists of Warsaw need just as like much support as they can possibly get, just like, just to keep everyone going, you know. I taught a woman who, or worked with a woman who had just been fired from her job teaching because she was a lesbian. It's like just a really Catholic country. But it was amazing to go there. There's a lot of salt mythology in it, and I got to go to the salt mine that's outside. It's outside Krakow, and you go. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it's just amazing. You go so far beneath the ground into this old salt mine that's not used anymore, and they just carve. It's just salt. You know, it's like the bedrock of salt, and they just carve into it like a. There's a giant cathedral, and it's salt. Like the chandelier salt, the altar salt, the floor salt, the statues are salt. There's like a giant salt statue of girder. It's just crazy. It's amazing. So I got to go there, and that figures into the third book. And the mermaid Serena, who's kind of one of the stars of the book, she is based on the actual mermaid Serena, who is in Polish mythology. She is sort of the guardian of the city of Warsaw and lives in the river Vistula. And when I went to Warsaw, I was walking along and then came upon this amazing, very simple but great sort of exhibit that was outside where it just showed the evolution of representations of Serena from the ages, going very, very, very far back when she didn't look human at all. She looked like some sort of blobular fish thing, you know, and then she sort of evolved into this sort of like Art Deco sexy mermaid, and you know, she's sort of like tore up in my book, you know, because I just think, you know, she's 100 years, you know, she's hundreds of years old, you know, she's been living in this river in Warsaw, which means she's lived through, you know, the Warsaw uprising and the Holocaust, German occupation. She's seen a lot, and she's seen a lot of loss, and so she's sort of this hard, harsh, awesome fish lady. So.
Thank you. This is David Levithan. He is a children's book editor in New York City and the author of several books, the author of many, many books, actually, for young adults, including Lambda Literary Award winner Two Boys Kissing, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, and Dash and Lily's Book of Dares, which is co-authored with Rachel Cohn, and Will Grayson, which is also co-authored, that's co-authored with John Green, and Every You, Every Me, and also Every Day and Another Day, two of his most recent books. He lives in New Jersey. So would you read for us for a little while?
Sure. So I'm horrified that I did not realize the bookstore would be so far from the venue, so I had to actually purchase my own book on my phone in order to read for you. So yeah, you're wondering, why is that on his phone? Well, yeah, no, I mean, I would have thought that too. I was like, I'm up here, I have no copy of my book.
Don't lie, you're just texting this entire
time. Exactly, exactly. Can you believe what Will is wearing today? I know, I should have asked in the audience, but now it guaranteed that I sold one book from this event. I had to buy it, but... So that is why I'm going to be reading from my phone. And I will be reading from Another Day. In order to introduce Another Day, I have to first introduce Every Day. Every Day is a book that I wrote that was published 3 years ago. It is about a person named A, who since birth has woken up every day in a different body, in a different life. And because of that, has grown up having no set gender, no set race, no set parents, no set DNA, basically has become a person just purely as a self. And it is not a spoiler to say that in the first chapter of Every Day, A, after 16 years of not really connecting with other people and just living life day by day, meets a girl named Rhiannon. And despite all of the desire not to connect, does connect with her and suddenly wants to come back to her and eventually falls in love with her and starts to have a sort of relationship with her. And I wrote that book to answer the question of what would your life be like if you weren't defined by your body, if you were purely a self, who would you be? What would it be like to love somebody else? And I eventually got to my answer for that, but I was really curious about the other side of the equation too, the notion of if you were in love with somebody who changed every day, what would that be like? We always like to say, oh, I love the you inside. I don't care about the packaging, I care with the gift underneath. But yet, even with small changes, oh, you've cut all your hair off. Oh, you're growing a mustache. I love it. It still takes some adjustment. So could you ask a 16-year-old girl to love somebody who changed every day? So I've chosen one of the more serious passages from the book. Strangely, it was not a passage I ever would have decided to read out loud, but I did a festival in Texas, and the moderator chose passages for us to read because she wanted us to read those. And I was like, this is crazy. And then I read it out loud. I was like, oh, good choice, moderator. So that is what I'm going to read. What you need to know is that A has told A's truth to Rhiannon. So Rhiannon does know that she has fallen for somebody who changes every day and is trying to adjust to that. And they keep in contact, and A has just called Rhiannon to say that A has woken up in the body of a girl who is suicidal. And A cannot really handle that and asks Rhiannon to come over and help. So that we join the story with Rhiannon on her way to this house. I don't know this girl. A hasn't told me much. But maybe that's why it's easier to fill in the blanks with myself. I shouldn't think it, but I think it anyway. This is the girl I'd be if I hadn't met Justin, my boyfriend. That's how bad it was. Or maybe that's just how bad it seemed. I don't know now. I can't tell the difference. All I know is I was convinced that nobody would care if I died. I had elaborate fantasies about my very simple funeral. No one but my relatives there. No boy in tears in the front row. No one who could get up and talk about me as if they really knew me. I knew I wasn't going to do it. But I also knew I could. I treasured that thought that I could. Most of the time, when we think we're looking for death, we're really looking for love. That was definitely the case with me, because Justin came in and gave me the meaning I was looking for. Justin became the mourner I wanted, and that led to other friends, other mourners. I populated my funeral until I didn't want one anymore. But I realize that's not always the case. I realize there are girls who don't have that. I realize I am driving toward one of them right now, not because of what A told me, but because of the sound of her voice, the fear. I recognize that. It's a short drive, but I try to come up with a plan. I'm not really thinking about A at all. I'm not wondering why A, who's lived in so many bodies, doesn't know what to do. I am not amazed that I know more than A does. I'm just driving and thinking as fast as I can. I find the house. It's a normal house. I ring the doorbell. It sounds like a normal doorbell. She answers, and from the moment I see her, I know that she's another disappearing girl, that she's desperately trying to disappear. The signs of it tattoo her body, the wear and tear. It is hard for unhealthy people to masquerade as healthy ones, especially once they've stopped caring if other people notice. The only difference is her eyes. Her eyes are still alive. I know that's not her. I know for sure now that this is actually happening. No trick, just truth. Plenty of feeling, but at the center of it, fact. Thank you for coming, A says.
Thank you. So your books are not, it's not, a, you don't have a book and then a sequel, but rather they're companion books. And one is told from the point of view of Rhiannon, a girl, and the other is told from someone who changes bodies, and sometimes the person is a boy and sometimes a girl, but we get the sense that he's a male, don't we? Maybe I just made that up.
You do. That is up to the reader. A is completely agendered, but...
So what was it, could you talk a little bit about that experience of telling the same story from different viewpoints?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was interesting because A obviously doesn't know why A is the way A is, but is used to it. And so telling the story from A's point of view, it is obviously a paranormal conceit, but it seems hopefully like realism, that this is just the way A's life is. And so telling the story from those eyes, it didn't seem quite as extraordinary because the character was used to it. But then to step back and see it through Rhiannon's eyes, who is just like the rest of us and cannot change bodies, not to make assumptions of everybody here. If you change bodies every day, I'm not talking about you. But it was interesting to then suddenly try to see it through a very realist eyes and try to understand the story from somebody who is very much bound in the rules that we think we have. And I certainly learned a lot about the story from that. I did not know when I wrote the first book that I was going to write the second. I wish I had. I would have set it up much better. You know, I keep saying it. If I had known that I was going to use the dialogue twice, I probably would have spent more time on the dialogue. But it was interesting. You can read either one first. You can absolutely read Another Day before every day, but I don't think I could have written them in a different order because I think I needed to see it through the more extraordinary set of eyes before I sort of cross-examined it with the more ordinary set.
I really love the way that those books make us step outside of what it is to what love is. You know, it makes love more than gender, more than even our biology, more than our bodies. It raised some really interesting philosophical questions. Thank you. So I'd like to ask a couple questions of all of you. First of all, two of you have written books that are just standalones, and when I write a book, by the time I'm finished with it, I am just done with it. And so did you have that, if you wrote standalones first, how was that psychologically, or how was that when you realized that you're going to stick with the book and you're going to write another book about the same story, you're going to extend the story?
Yeah, I definitely have had some moments where I'm like, I can't believe I have to keep writing about mermaids in Poland. Like, I got it. I'm satisfied. I went to Poland. I'm done, you know? But I'm also kind of long-winded, and I tend to write longer. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, it's been sort of satisfying to really get to stretch a story out and tell this great big story. Yeah. So, it depends on my mood. Like, sometimes I definitely feel oppressed by what I've set myself up to mm-hmm. do. But then, honestly, once I get into... It's more when I'm away from the story that I feel like that. Once I actually sit down with it and kind of plug back in, I really enjoy it. I enjoy the characters. It is a really sweet feeling to create characters and then get to keep returning to them, yeah. You know? It is a very, very sweet feeling. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm the same way that usually when a book is done, the story is done, which is different. Rachel, who I've written three books with, she continues the story in her head. So if you asked, so what did Nick and Nora do a year later? I'd be like, oh, I don't know. And she'd be like, well, here's where they're living now. And here, like, she has a sense of it. So I'm often asked sort of, oh, are you going to write a sequel? Oh, what happens next? And I'm usually like, no, there's a reason the book ends when it does. Like, that's when the story is over. With Every Day, it was a little different because I did know that there was a bigger story behind the story I was telling. And I made a conscious choice that I would not tell that story in the first book, mm-hmm. But I certainly planted things for a sequel in the book. And then I finished the book, and I went to my editor. I said, should I start writing the second book, for being the actual sequel, not Another Day? And she said, well, why don't we wait and see how it does and maybe take some time to think about it? And I was like, okay, good. And then just dropped it. And then what was interesting is when the book came out, I certainly noticed the way people were reading it and what it meant to them and the discussions that were happening. And I felt suddenly that the sequel that I'd planned to write was not the book that anybody wanted to read. And so I thought, you know what, maybe I won't write it. We'll see. And then Another Day happened. I was asked to do something as bonus material, and I started rewriting the first chapter of Every Day in Rhiannon's voice, and within two pages was like, oh, this is a novel. So when I say I didn't intend to write it, I genuinely didn't, but once that was there, that was interesting to me. And when I finished Another Day, I realized that I still did want to go back and write the sequel, which I will in a couple of years, that the story that I plotted, sort of the bigger story, is still there. But it is very hard for me as a writer to grapple with, because it's still very unknown to me, and I'm very aware that I'm going to have to completely filter out all of the feedback I've gotten for the first two books to try to write the third book the way that I would want it, not the way that necessarily the readers would want it.
Yeah, it seems like it would be hard to just be able to think of a new book and not have people's opinions about the first books kind of overpower you.
Yeah, no, I mean, as an editor, I'm always telling my authors who are writing series, always try to finish book two before book one comes out, so that it's still purely yours. You're not basing the story on anything, any discussions you've had about it. But I am not able to follow my own advice this time.
That's the way advice is,
yeah,
isn't it?
Of course.
All of you have minor characters in your books that are very mysterious and interesting and not developed. And so I think that for each, yours is Henny, yours is the ghost, and yours is Alexander, the boy at the end of the second book. And so I wonder if that's a device that you use so that you'll develop that in your next book. Do you intentionally do that? Do you intentionally put characters in there who we just want to know more about, and then you don't quite tell us?
I've gotten comments about that, actually. As much as I've got a number of different side characters who are very weakly developed or underdeveloped intentionally, Jacoby is my title character, is intentionally a bit mysterious, and there's a bit of his background that we don't ever know. And as we get a little further in, I'm just finishing it. It's on book three now, and a little more has come out. And sort of the more you know, the more you realize you don't know about the character. And that's especially, I mean, I'm writing mystery genre, so that's right away kind of part of the appeal, is that there's things that you don't know, and that's much more interesting. And as much as I get arrogant and think that I'm an awesome author, nothing that comes out of my brain is going to be as good as what somebody reading the book is going to come up with. So it's a nice way of letting somebody else fill in the blanks in that way also. But there are always ideas in my head of what's behind things.
The Henny character in my first book was, there. I grew up on this street in Chelsea, and way down at the end of it was this sort of grocery store called Henny's, and this lady Henny ran it. And it was like this weird place where it did feel very old world, and like nobody really shopped there, and you're like, who goes there? And it was like something kind of creepy about it, and you know, she was sort of like old world and witchy in a way that like kids kind of feel repelled by, you know, and I just always thought about her, you know, and so I brought her into the book, and got a little bit more interested in, like, you know, what if she was a witch? What would she be like? And she's the sister, the sort of like good witch sister of Kishka. And I don't know if she'll, I mean, I know what she's doing right now in Chelsea, you know, like kind of everyone's talking about, like, I know what she's doing, and her loose ends will be tied up in the final book, but I don't know how much deeper we'll get into her. A sort of wonderful, terrifying thing about I'm finding about doing something like this is, like, once you're three books in, you can kind of write like 50. Like, I could just, now I've got all these characters and I've created this world, and it's like, oh my God, I could kind of keep going forever. Not that anyone necessarily wants that to happen, but I feel like I could do it, so.
I mean, for me, I mean, certainly the characters that might come up later on are more towards the end of the book, so I don't want to talk about them too much, because I'm not going to presume that all of you have read these two books already. But so those are the deliberately the ones that might lead to something else. But I think what has been interesting is, I mean, because A does live in a different life every day, you do get a glimpse of all of these different people as the book goes on, and then in another day you get to revisit some of them. And it has been deeply frustrating to some readers that you're only seeing them for a day, that you don't know what happens anymore. Kelsey, from the chapter I read, being probably the most where people want to know more. And it's unfortunate because that is deliberate. I mean, that is how A lives A's life, that you are just there for a day and then you have no idea what happens next unless you happen to come across them again and remember them. But I wanted the reader's frustration to mirror A's frustration and to see that. So I dramatically or narratively, that is frustrating, but it is deliberately frustrating.
Yeah, that's smart.
Have you been thinking about your questions out there? Can we take mics around to people who want to ask questions? There's a hand back there.
My question is going back to it, whether or not you plan to write a sequel. Since we're so out there, there's social media and everything, do you find yourself tempted to fulfill reader hopes and expectations, or are you contrary, like, well, so-and-so was gonna live, but now they're not, or do you try to filter it all out? How do you react to, like, expectations and reviews and things like that?
We were talking about that just briefly before this, that I have frequently gotten the advice that you need to stay off of Goodreads, stay off of the, you know, review sites and things, and much like David, I'm terrible at listening to advice. So I do listen to things, but at this point I've got a fourth book at least plotted in my head, and I've got a third book that's done. So the nice thing about looking at those reviews now is that I kind of have to go, that's an interesting idea, nope, that's not happening. And it's good to be at that point, but yeah, you really do have to try at least to very actively stay true to the vision that you had to begin with. I think there are things though that, I mean, my book wasn't what it is now when I started. When I first wrote my book, the very, very first version of it, the narrator character was both male and unnamed. The main voice of the book, I thought I was being very clever by writing somebody who any reader could just sort of put themselves inside this mask and see the world of cool, kooky things happening. And it turns out when you give a character no character, they're boring. Who knew? And so it was only because I listened to advice of not, you know, the wider masses in Goodreads, but just people who are smart and in my immediate circle, people like my editor and my wife and people who are intelligent, who I respect, who suggested maybe some personality, maybe a gender, maybe female would be nice. And so after having done that, I realized with very few efforts on my own part, just changing pronouns, I wound up realizing that it was a better book. So you need sort of the confidence to write your book, but the humility to write your book well, and that comes from listening to other people.
I don't know that I'm aware of what expectations are for this series. I definitely avoid reading reviews on the internet as a practice, as a lifestyle. It's a spiritual practice. I don't read reviews. I mean, if something comes out in a paper or something like that, then I kind of can't resist. But if I have a heads up that it's a terrible review, I just won't read it. Because what are you going to do? The book's written, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and for me, the same thing. I don't read Goodreads or Amazon reviews or anything like that. But it is, I certainly have conversations with readers about the book when I'm on tour, when we have Q&As like this. Things come out, and I don't think it's ever about plot or the character should do this. I would roundly ignore any request for that. But it is more seeing what people are reading in the story and sort of seeing sort of what themes are coming up or what questions are being raised. Certainly, I view having another book as an opportunity to answer those questions or to address them if I feel that maybe I didn't address them as much in the first book, or if clearly there is more room to explore, then it does point me in the direction of trying to explore that.
Is it my turn now? Okay. How do you kind of define the point of view, like with like word choice, make sure that when you're writing, especially from a first person perspective, that it sounds like the voice, that it's very clearly defined, especially when you go, when you write what the book from one perspective and then you kind of rewrite it from another perspective, from a different character's perspective. So how do you, would you differentiate from those and make the voice clearly defined to the reader? Do you have any advice for that, I guess?
I mean, for me, the key to the voice is to just sort of, I always write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite my first three chapters until I feel that I've gotten the voice right, and then I give myself permission to go on. And that's true whether it's a character I've known already or it's a new character. For this, it was actually very lucky because I felt I knew Rhiannon from the first book and sort of had a very good sense of her and how she would talk from the first book. So writing a second book in her voice was pretty easy. And then when I was rereading it, I would go through and I would just really ask myself, is this exactly the way Rhiannon would say it? That certainly the way she talks is very different from the way A talks. And if I slipped in the storytelling and suddenly Rhiannon didn't sound like her, I would have to edit it and revise it to be more consistent. So I didn't really impose that lens on it while I was writing. I tried to just be in her headspace, but certainly I think the key to a smooth voice is more in the revision process and really questioning. And sometimes it hurts because some of your characters, like Rhiannon, are not the most articulate of characters. And so you may deploy this amazing metaphor that you're like, wow, I have seen everything in a new light because of this amazing articulation that is so brilliant. And then when you're revising, you read it and you're like, there is no way this character would ever have thought that. And so you kill your darling and you're like, I'm gonna cut and paste this into a separate Word document so I could hopefully use this metaphor somewhere else. But if it's not her and doesn't feel like her, then it needs to go.
Yeah, that. I mean, it's pretty much just really knowing your characters, which you just get to know by just doing the writing and then doing the revising. I find writing really kind of intuitive, where I just like to just get in it and just do it and like not trip too hard, just like let it come out. But then, you know, going back and, you know, once I've accumulated maybe like 50 pages, when I sit down to write, I'll sort of comb through those 50 pages to get myself back into the headspace, into the mood, and you start being able to see what's a clunker, you know, if somebody's thinking about something or using a metaphor or reference point that they wouldn't necessarily have access to. It kind of starts standing out to you, and you can make those tweaks in the editing process. But I find that writing and editing are really different activities, and so when I'm writing, sometimes I'll just throw something out there and I'll be like, I know that's not quite right and I'm just gonna let it ride for now because I could be 3 pages deeper into this story or I could just sit here for 15 minutes tweaking this thing. And so it's just sort of like having to make that kind of a call.
Absolutely, I teach also and I tell my students frequently, write garbage, get it out there because you can edit garbage. You can't edit a blank page. For me, I'm writing a character who is female, and I get people asking me, is it hard to write from a female perspective? And like, you should talk to David. He's writing from back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But I find, like, it wasn't hard for me because Rook is closest to my personality. And so while I'm thinking about what would I do in that situation at, you know, turn of the century, which is kind of a weird situation, I'm still thinking, what would I do if someone was expecting this of me, and how would I feel, and how would I react? So that feels fairly natural. It does take a lot of revision and going back and reading over that passage that you thought was brilliant, and then you realize that's not how people talk. That's totally wrong. But then every once in a while, the thing that catches me the most is writing a period piece. So I'm writing turn of the century. I'm writing 1892 is my year, and there are certain ways that you talk. And so I read a lot of Sherlock Holmes, and I read a lot of the Japan Mysteries by Edgar Allan Poe, and Charlotte Perkins Gilman, The Yellow Wallpaper, is one that I teach regularly. It's nice to kind of immerse myself in these voices from around the time. But then there's sort of a hesitance to write really accurately for that time because my students don't want to read The Yellow Wallpaper every day. And so I've got my demographic marches through my room hundreds by the day. And so I know what's approachable and what my students really love and get into and what I get into, because I read a lot of the YA that my students are reading also. And so making something that was really, really period accurate was not necessarily what I wanted to do, because sort of modern pacing feels very different than Edgar Allan Poe's pacing. And so it's finding that balance for me was the harder thing, writing something that felt period accurate while still having modern sensibilities, modern readabilities. And that was the hardest part for me. And again, as both of these more brilliant authors have said, it's the editing process. It's reading it and reading it and reading it and changing it and changing it and changing it. And it's hard sometimes even now to go back over a fully published book of mine and go, that one sentence just a little bit. But it is what it is now. So yeah, edit a lot is the answer.
We had a question right back here. Oh, good, you've got a mic.
Great. So my question is for David. You were reading in first person present, which I've written in third person close past and first person past, and I just had a book that I realized it's about a potential suicide of the main character, and if I wrote it in first person past, you knew that she didn't choose that way. So it was a tell. And so I went to first person present, and I wondered if you had any advice about writing in first person present and what the pitfalls can be.
I mean, I think that it's funny because I think that past is trickier, and as an editor, I'm always sort of cross-examining my authors, saying, okay, what vantage point are you telling the story from? Like, are you acknowledging it? Whereas present, I usually default to present because the characters don't know what's going to happen, and they are blanker slates, and because of that, it is much more involving. And the truth of the matter is, It also mirrors my writing process. I'm completely a pantser. I do not plot at all. And so the fact that the characters are in present tense is very reflective of the fact that as I'm writing, I'm in present tense, that I'm experiencing the story without forethought, a lot of the times without knowing what is going to happen. So I'm telling the story as it's happening, and it makes sense for present tense. I think that the key for present tense is to, you have to make sure that there isn't any foreshadowing and there isn't any pre-knowledge that comes across in the writing, or else your present tense falls apart. But I think that if the characters in the writing is, it just continues to be in the moment, then the present tense makes sense.
I think we have time for one more question. So right here.
Not gonna lie, first off, I've only ever read Will Grayson, although I do plan on continuing to read more of your novels now. mine was more specifically focused on A and their frustrations of skipping between bodies day by day. Has A ever gone back and been so enticed by one specific body and one specific person that they've set out to learn what happened to that person?
I mean, I think A's point of view evolves throughout every day. So specifically addressing A sort of at the start of every day, I think A very early on just detached and learned that the only way to get through was to detach. That if you were changing every day, it would be devastating to form attachments to a family or to friends or to a life and then wake up the next morning and not have it and have no way to get back to it. And so it's almost like a protective shell that A has developed to get through life. And so at the beginning of the book, certainly A is not curious because A doesn't allow A self to be curious. It is only after A meets Rhiannon that, and that attachment forms, that A does start to think about some of the lives that A has been in. So that's sort of part of the twist. I mean, the whole book is about that shell cracking. And so as the book progresses, you see more and more of what A has not been letting in as well as what A has let in.
I was just going to ask really quickly, do you guys have any writers or specific books that you love so much and you feel like have not got enough play and not big enough readership that you think we should miss out on?
A short question. This is like, how long do you have?
Pressure is on. Oh, my goodness.
Jumping in, one that got a lot of play but has kind of fallen out, I was just talking about P.G. Wodehouse is one of my absolute favorites, wrote the Jeeves stories and P. Smith, marvelous writer, satirical British writer, and then one an American author, Patricia C. Reedy, who wrote the Dealing with Dragons, the Enchanted Forest series beginning with Dealing with Dragons, and that's one that does kind of what I like to do. It's one of the books that I read as a kid and loved that was taking a fairy tale and turning it on its head. And I'm thrilled, actually, that's starting to come back. I think it's an OBAB book, an Oregon Battle of the Books book this year, which I was really happy to see making resurgence. So those two are mine.
Linda Barry's Cruddy. I know a lot of people have read and loved that book, but I feel like everyone should read and love that book, you know? So I guess that's what I would say. It's also Laurie Weeks' book, Zippermouth. Probably hasn't gotten as much attention, for sure. It was like, has anyone here read Zippermouth by Laurie Weeks? Oh, my heart. Go get it, it's so amazing.
My go-tos are always M.T. Anderson's Feed and Francesca Leah Block's Sweetsibat. And for more recently, even though I am desperately, desperately, desperately hoping it wins the National Book Award next week, if you have not read Neil Schusterman's Challenger Deep yet, it is easily my favorite YA book of the year.
Thanks for your great questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was David Levithan, Michelle T., and William Ritter in conversation at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in November 2015, in an event entitled The Other Side of the Story, Fantastic Sequels. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces The Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.